This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Progressive helps you compare direct auto rates from a variety of companies so you can find a great one, even if it's not with them. Quote today at progressive.com to find a rate that works with your budget. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, November 19th, 1919, say that three times fast, November 19th, 1919, the U.S. Senate, for the first time in its history, rejects a peace treaty, the Treaty of Versailles. The treaty was the most important of the peace treaties that brought an end to World War I. It was a treaty that President Woodrow Wilson backed, had been negotiating along with the nations of Europe for months and months. As those negotiations concluded, Wilson declared that, quote, "At last the world knows America as the savior of the world." But when he brought it home to the U.S. Senate for ratification, things got complicated, and ultimately the Republican-led Senate rejected the treaty. So here to discuss the rejection of Versailles is, as always, Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki.
Hello, Jody.
And our special guest for this episode, Christopher McKnight Nichols, director of the Center for Humanities and a professor of history at Oregon State University. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Hey, hi. Nice to be on with you.
Yeah, you know your stuff about this. So tell us, what were the objections stateside to the treaty?
Yeah, so it became a pitched battle in the Senate in November 1919 and all throughout really the summer into the fall over the Treaty of Versailles and especially the League of Nations. That was the sticking point. And within debates about the League of Nations, there were roughly three broad kind of themes that they clustered around. The first was about keeping the U.S. out of entangling alliances as a general principle, avoiding binding commitments, political, military, diplomatic. The second was about the arbitration of the peace itself and kind of keeping the U.S. out of a leadership role in that or not doing something that would be immoral. So the nature of the treaty and the ways in which some of the articles in the League of Nations, for instance, supported colonialism was another piece of that. And then a third sort of category of issues and objections revolved around the question of balancing foreign and domestic commitments. And really, a lot of senators, Democrats, as well as Republicans who either wanted some reservations in the treaty or wanted to reject it outright, focused on improving the U.S. at home, saying the U.S. had had this adventure abroad, that's enough, end this, and certainly don't join the League.
I feel like you can hear in that description the anxiety over what the U.S.'s role in the world was going to be. And it gives you the sense of both possibility and anxiety at the turn of the 20th century of, all right, we got involved in this war, little controversial even that. And now what do we do? Do we stay involved in the rest of the world? Do we come home and act like all of that didn't happen? Like, what are we going to be now that we've been this big player on the world stage?
Yeah. I read that quote from Wilson, we're going to be seen as the savior of the world now. That's pretty high stakes stuff. Why was he convinced that that was possible? Was he blindsided by the fact that he would come back and people would be like, no, maybe we shouldn't have the world see us this way?
Yeah, you know, I think for him, he famously said, it's this league or no league when he finally gets to the final votes. And even though there was possible to pass it with reservations, so this could have happened, and that's something we can get into, the internal politics of this, which is really fascinating. But at the broader takeaway sort of set of perspectives, I think Nikki and Jody, you're totally right. This is about the meaning of America in terms of diplomacy, coming out of the U.S.'s first ever really global war, first ever war fighting alongside European allies, first ever war fighting on the continent of Europe. And the stakes couldn't be higher, really, if you think about it. This was called in that era the doctrine of the free hand, and really trying to push American unilateral possibilities and not get constrained by kind of multilateral utopianism, frankly.
Yeah, but Nikki, I mean, this is the part of the story that I just can't fully get my head around just from a political perspective, from Wilson's perspective, right? Because he gets to kind of set the bar for himself in terms of what this means. And he seems to set it as high as possible, right? We have saved the world. But if he knows that there's objections, and it seems to me like for years this was controversial and there were problems, like why does he set that bar for himself and then come walk right back into the Senate fight where it's going to get super complicated?
Because Wilson's a true believer. I mean, he really does believe that he is in a save the world position here. And he believes that through the power of his both personality and persuasion, he is going to talk to those senators individually and get them on board. And when he doesn't get them on board, he's going to go out to the nation and he's going to convince Americans that this is the role that we are supposed to take on. It is our destiny as Americans. And that is what is fueling just this extremely high stakes and huge language that he's using, that again, like it makes it very difficult for him to back down once he's laid that claim that the U.S. is now going to be the savior of the world.
Yeah. And Jody, he's got evidence for this, right? He arrived in Paris to millions of people out there cheering him as the negotiator. Right. When he comes back to the U.S. with this, he's got hundreds of thousands of people out at ticker tape parades. Maybe 100,000 people meet him at Union Station in D.C. at midnight when he comes back after negotiating this. He thinks he's got a mandate. But what he's missing, of course, is the election of 1918, which turned over the Senate to Henry Cabot Lodge, or turned over the ability of the Republicans to hamstring him, to use filibusters, to set the agenda. And this is where you're also right. You know, he should have been sharper on these politics. And this is something that historians look at and really castigate him for, as well as fellow Democrats in the moment. They often said, you know, he was slain by his own sort of goodwill and best intentions, but he was slain because, as Nikki said, right, he was a true believer.
The Republican senators that we're talking about here that objected to this treaty, they were in power because of the previous year's election, the 1918 midterms. Obviously, that election took place while the war was still going on, but were there seeds of this battle in that election? Was the kind of Wilsonian view of the U.S.'s role in the world an issue in that midterm?
So a couple things. Like, first, Wilson really tried to make this midterm election a referendum on his policies about the war, and he lost. He was repudiated at the polls. So the Republicans get major gains, something like 25 seats in the House and just enough, about five in the Senate, to get a narrow majority. And it is pretty clear that that's a repudiation of his foreign policy, of a war that, frankly, we don't think about enough. It was unpopular. World War I was not a very popular war. The draft was not popular in the U.S. Second, that's a pandemic election. So the flu pandemic's going on. There's a lot less turnout, roughly 10 to 15% less turnout. And third, there was all this social tumult in the summer of 1919 that also undercut Wilson's ability to focus fully on getting the treaty through the Senate.
I'm curious how much of the fight between Republicans and Wilson then. I mean, was it over these big, sweeping, overarching ideas, or was some of it partisan? Because somebody like Henry Cabot Lodge, right, he kind of hates Wilson as a person. So how much of it is that personal and partisan, and how much of it is this really philosophical fight?
So I think they're blended, but you're really right to point that out. One of my favorite letters of Henry Cabot Lodge is a private letter where he says, "I never thought I could hate this much." And he's talking about Wilson, right? So the personal animus is huge. They hate each other. But it's also because, you know, Lodge wanted to go to Paris. He wanted Republicans to be part of the negotiating process. I mean, this is classic politics, right? He did not bring a team of rivals at all. So, you know, the personal animus and the way that he went about this, the sort of a lot of the Democrats and almost all the Republicans think of Wilson as an autocrat. They use this term a lot, that he just thought he knew better than everyone. He was the smartest man in the room kind of thing. And they deeply resent that. And when they have power, as we all know in political history, they wield it.
That Lodge quote, people compare Henry Cabot Lodge to Miami Heat guard Tim Hardaway all the time, but I will just point out that Miami Heat guard Tim Hardaway has this quote about the Knicks where he says, "I hate the Knicks as much as I can hate. Can you hate the Knicks more than that? Then I hate them that much." So, yes, great moments in learning the outer limits of hatred. Let's talk a little bit about the objections to the League of Nations itself. What were the specific objections, and what do they say about how people were viewing our role in the world?
So if you need to reduce it all down to one thing, you need to know about Article 10 of the League of Nations Covenant. And that article said, I'll quote it right here, "The members of the League undertake to respect and preserve, as against external aggression, the territorial integrity and existing political independence of all members of the League. In case of any such aggression, or in case of any threat or danger of such aggression, the Council shall advise upon the means by which this obligation shall be fulfilled." In other words, member nations are obliged to support other member nations if they're attacked. So Republicans in the Senate said, look, this goes against Washington and Jefferson, no entangling alliances. This maybe takes away Congress's power to declare war. It certainly gets the U.S. imbricated into all kinds of conflicts that may not be in the nation's vital interest. Wilson, in contrast, says, hey, this is moral, not legal. It's up to the Congress to declare war. And really what we're saying is we pledge to support our member nations. And he says, basically, if you eviscerate this, if you take this out with a reservation in the treaty, this is just a debating society, and the League of Nations will have no teeth and therefore will really not operate to prevent a next future war. And he famously says, when he's on the stump trying to get the American people to support this, I can guarantee in one generation, American troops will have to go across the sea if this league isn't put into effect as it stands. Very prescient kind of claim there.
And you can imagine the turmoil and people trying to play this out in their minds. Because, of course, we remember that Wilson quote because it turns out Second World War a couple decades later. But people had also just seen Europe get entangled in this continent-wide conflagration because everyone had all of these alliances that were dragging them into war. And so you could imagine somebody in 1919 looking at this and saying, okay, so now we have a mutual defense alliance. So when somebody attacks Belgium, then all of a sudden we're involved in another one of these unpopular wars over on a different continent. And so there's something about the kind of lived experience of that moment that feels really important.
Chris, when you were listing off some of the objections to the treaty, you mentioned something about objections to the nature of colonialism. What was going on there?
Great question. So what's fascinating in this moment is there's something called the Article 22 of the League Covenant, which provides the key components for a mandate system, a system of observing and holding colonies coming out from under imperial powers in the wake of the war, which we know that colonialism was a huge part of starting World War I in the first place. American observers, especially Republicans who are anti-imperialist, really object to some of the side deals that were made related to the war and the Treaty of Versailles, and the fact that then the U.S. would be part of this sort of slow-moving, still continuing colonial process of overseeing peoples and groups around the world.
But just to clarify, I mean, it seems like the objections were mostly about how the colonial pie was getting split up. Were there people who were objecting on moral grounds to colonialism?
You know, the U.S. had really just begun to get overseas colonies not long before this point in time, right? After the Spanish-American War in 1898, all of a sudden the U.S. has all these colonial holdings that it's trying to decide what to do with. And there's a real debate in the United States over whether or not the U.S. is going to be part of this imperial race that's happening all over the world. And there is a real anti-imperialism, anti-colonialist argument and faction in the United States because it seems so contrary to the United States origins as an anti-imperial colony throwing off its imperial overlords. And so, you know, we don't necessarily always think of the 19-teens as this time of burgeoning anti-imperialism, because I think we tend to think of anti-colonialism as more of a 1950s and 1960s kind of thing. But there definitely was a contingent of Americans who were very much opposed to this imperial project.
Let's come back to this moment that we're marking here with this episode, which is when the U.S. Senate rejects the Treaty of Versailles. The treaty does get ratified by most of the countries in Europe. The League of Nations does exist, just without the United States. And so I take your point about how this may have planted the seeds for World War II a decade or two later. But in the nearer term, does the U.S. rejection of the treaty have a tangible effect on the kind of peace that's being brokered in Europe?
It has relatively little effect related to the peace being brokered in Europe. Historians have done a good job documenting the fact that the Americans are advisors on virtually every major committee in the League, and that Americans are invested in lots of outcomes, particularly American jurists. International law is burgeoning in this era. And so you've got a lot of American lawyers involved even in writing elements of League structures, changing their mandates, which were what took over the old colonies. So in some ways, the U.S. isn't able to be an actor for significant good through the League, but the U.S.'s absence is more one of formal structures rather than the informal ones through which Americans are very much involved and invested in the League's operations.
How much, when you look at this, the language around why this treaty was rejected, how much should we think of a lot of the language right now that's being employed about pulling out from international agreements? And, you know, I mean, was anyone back then saying the equivalent of other countries should pay their fair share, and until they do, you know, we're taking our ball and going home?
Yeah, there were a lot of concerns that were floating to the surface that are really familiar to us today. One is this idea that the U.S. will be losing its sovereignty if it joins one of these organizations, that all of a sudden international law is going to overrule, you know, U.S. law, the Constitution will sort of be null and void if we join this. And also that the U.S. economically and otherwise does not have a role to play in the squabbles of Europe, I think is probably the biggest message coming out of this, is that we don't need to fund their wars and we certainly don't need to fight their wars, is something you hear quite a lot of.
Yeah. So listeners to this show will know that the last time we talked about peace negotiations at the end of World War One was in the context of pointing out that Wilson had the flu when he went to Paris in April, I think it was. And that was the negotiations to wind down the war. And these are the negotiations to sort of settle the parameters of peace. But is Wilson's flu and just the flu in general, how does that play into the story we're discussing right now, Chris?
A lot. If the flu, but also his health generally. I mean, I think one of the really important things to think about as we think about this moment, the rejection of the Treaty of Versailles, is that Wilson's declining health is a big explanatory piece of why he miscalculates consistently on the politics. There could have been a compromise league passed. He had the votes for that. They needed 2/3 in the Senate, but he rejected those compromises. He was not very effective in doing the kind of political arm twisting that he was better at in past years. He gave a 40-minute speech that was kind of rambling and full of platitudes when he first introduces the treaty in its near final form to the Senate in July 1919. He meets with all the major players who object. In the summer of 1919, the Republicans, people like William Borah, the arch isolationist from Idaho, Hiram Johnson from California, and they're all not impressed with him. They think he just isn't on his game. And a big part of that is what we now understand to be the early signs of his worsening cardiovascular, arteriovascular issues that result in a stroke that he has in Pueblo, Colorado, September 25th, 1919, when he's out on a barnstorming tour trying to gin up the popular support for the league. And there's rival tours that are happening with those same folks, Johnson and Borah, trying to depress interest in the league. And that's another interesting question, because the American people at first seem very excited about the league concept. And by the time you get to these votes, Republicans have played it out. They've filibustered, they've slowed things down, they've had lots of hearings. And by the time you get to this first vote in November 1919, Wilson's had a stroke, he's infirm, he can't perform as he used to, and the Republicans have really outmaneuvered him.
Yeah, I think that stroke is such an important part of this story because it comes when Wilson is like 2/3 of the way through barnstorming around the country, rallying support. And there were people like Lodge who were watching these huge crowds come out for Wilson and were pretty concerned that he was going to get the nation behind him. And he was actually doing a fairly good job of that. And then his stroke and his incapacitation meant that that rallying comes to an abrupt end. And he loses that momentum that he had while he was crossing the country. So I'm curious, Chris, I mean, is this a story of Republican obstruction of Democratic policies, or is there something different going on here?
Yeah, so one thing that's fascinating is that the group that comes together that absolutely opposes the League of Nations in the U.S. Senate is a group called the Irreconcilables. And they're led by people like William Borah from Idaho and Hiram Johnson from California, but there's also a number of Democrats in there. So it's a really, you know, you might call it a set of strange bedfellows, if you will. That's what they would have in that era, at least, said. So some of these folks are Republican progressive reformers, and some are Democratic segregationists. It's a very odd group, but it tells us something about the nature of bipartisanship in international affairs in that era, which they would have referred to as partisanship stops at water's edge.
Mm. Did they call themselves the Irreconcilables, or is that a name history has given them?
They did wind up embracing that name immediately thereafter. The Lodge group were called the Reservationists, and Lodge wound up writing reservations for 14 total reservations. And then there was another group called Mild Reservationists, which was referred to in the time as that, but they did not like that term, that language.
I gotta say, Irreconcilables is a much better name than any of those other ones.
Yeah, though it sort of tips your hand a little bit about how these negotiations are gonna go.
Fair enough.
Yes.
And Jody, speaking of Irreconcilable, we should say what happens with Lodge and with Wilson.
There you go. Nicely done. Yeah.
Wilson, as we were talking about, was quite ill and he never really fully recovers. And in 1924, he dies. And Lodge is going to go to his funeral. And Edith Wilson, the president's widow, sends him a note that says, "Realizing that your presence would be embarrassing to you and unwelcome to me, I write to request that you do not attend." So Irreconcilable to the end.
Wow, that's amazing. And I mean, you know, it's a reminder these are human beings who, you know, have fallings out. But at least, you know, this one was like a falling out over a really high-minded thing. This at least was about America's place in the world.
That's right.
All right. Well, let's leave it there. Christopher McKnight-Nichols, thank you so much for doing this. This was great.
It's great to be on with you. Thanks so much.
And Nicole Hemmer of Columbia, thanks to you as always.
Thank you, Jody.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX. Now, you're going to hear me say this over the next few weeks, but we are getting towards the end of the year where you're likely to hear more fundraising appeals from lots of the places you support. And this show and Radiotopia are independent productions. Listener support is a big part of the pie that helps make this show. So for what it's worth, if you want to support us directly and have the means to as we get towards the end of the year, there is a form on our website where you can do that, thisdaypod.com. And of course, the real way to support the show is just to keep listening and keep spreading the word and keep emailing us. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Our researcher and producer is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. Kala Nakua helps with transcripts. You can find links to the transcripts for every episode on our website, thisdaypod.com. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia.